The Destiny Foundation presents Rabbi Beryl Wein's Travels Through Jewish History. This, the 95th tape in the series, is entitled Egypt, Feudalism, and Imperialism, delivered in 1988. We hope you enjoy.
My friends, on the coldest night of the year, we're going to talk about sunny Egypt. Until now, we have been able to trace the origins of the Jewish people through the time of the patriarchs, Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, till the beginnings of the Jewish people in the land of Egypt. And in the next lecture, we'll talk about Joseph and Egypt. But tonight, I'd like to talk to you about Egypt itself, because that is a very important subject and a vital subject for us to understand the whole backdrop of the Chumash of the Bible and to understand the role that the Jewish people filled in that society and the influence that the Egyptian society had upon the Jews as well. Egypt was the exception to all of the rules in the ancient world. By that I mean it was a fully self-sufficient, wealthy country. All of the other countries in the Near East and Mesopotamia were all dependent either upon war or upon trade or upon expansion of the economy to feed themselves. There was no breadbasket. There was no granary in the Middle East. But Egypt was the exception, because Egypt had and still has today, though today it has to a lesser extent because of its tremendous population problems, but Egypt had then an economy that was fully self-sufficient. It didn't need anyone. Everything that they needed, they grew. They were an exporting country from the first day on. And therefore, in that type of society, a great wealthy class arose. Far more of the Egyptian people were wealthy than of any other people in the ancient world. Well, that's not saying that most of the Egyptians were wealthy. If probably 2 or 3% were wealthy, that was a lot. And the other 98, 97% were, as is the case of all the masses in the world, downtrodden, didn't really have much of an opportunity, didn't really have much wealth, and didn't really have much of the opportunity to do anything. But they had 3% wealthy, where in Mesopotamia you had barely a half of 1% wealthy. And among the Canaanites, you had almost no percent wealthy, with the exception of the king and the few noblemen. So in relative terms, as we speak about this, Egypt was far different because it had this inborn wealth. It had the ability to support itself. And as we see in the Chumash itself, in the years of the Great Famine, Egypt was able to withstand the Great Famine, at least for the first 2 years, and able to withstand it to an extent that it was able to export grain to the rest of the world by selling the grain. The rest of the world dried up in a month, dried up immediately, because the rest of the world, or the known civilized world, the world of the Mediterranean, the world of the Fertile Crescent, was always on a hand-to-mouth basis. There were no resources upon which one could call in emergency. It's a little like the yeshiva's budget. Right? There's nothing left, right? If the check doesn't come in on Tuesday that you counted on, so then that's it. The whole place goes up in smoke. Well, that is how the economy of the ancient world worked. Now, there are a great many economies in the world today that work that way. Individual economies and national economies. And it's not unheard of to be able to keep the ball rolling for hundreds of years without any resources. But that's not the optimum scenario. It's not the way people like to operate. It's certainly not the way countries like to operate. And therefore, what made Egypt different than all of the other countries in the ancient world was its natural resources, its wealth, the fact that Egypt, out of all of the other countries in the world, did not require any outside aid whatsoever, and didn't have to resort to war, didn't have to resort to expansion or conquest in order to be able to be a great country. And we find that description in the Chumash itself. In the Bible it says, Kigan Hashem Boacho Mitzrayimu. Like the Garden of God as you enter Egypt. Egypt was called the Garden of God. And that was all due to that great river, the Nile, which over the centuries, by flooding, produced layer upon layer of mud, and then it became good earth, and it grew everything. And when you had a narrow population, today Egypt is approaching 65 million people, which is absolutely mind-boggling, because in 1948 Egypt was 25 million people. If you think people talk about the demographic time bomb in the Middle East, the demographic time bomb is not in the Gaza Strip. The demographic time bomb is Egypt. Because you're adding a million people a year to an economy that can't do it. Eventually there are going to be problems, severe problems. But we're talking about in Egypt, the scholars disagree. That's what makes them scholars. There are some that say that there were 1.5 million Egyptians. We're talking here about the time of Jacob, the entry of the Jewish people into the scene in Egypt. So I'll go over the dynasties with you in a few moments. But we're talking approximately the year 1500 before the Common Era, 1600 before the Common Era. About 3,500 years ago. So the estimates range from 1.5 million to 5 million Egyptians. But even if we take the outside large figure of 5 million Egyptians, 5 million Egyptians can be supported very handsomely in the Nile Delta. And the Nile River formed a fertile valley that ran for hundreds and hundreds of miles from Alexandria in the north through Thebes and what is today Cairo, Luxor, all the way south to what is today the Sudan. And in a narrow belt, probably no more than 25 miles wide, with the Nile at its center, so let's say about 15 miles on either side of the Nile, you had tremendous fertility. And that's where all the cities were built. They were built on the Nile. And that's where all the farming was done, and that's where civilization, that's where the cities existed. If you went more than 25 miles off the Nile in either direction, you came to what the Egyptians called the black dirt. The black dirt meant the desert. The red dirt meant fertility, meant life. And they all grouped along that river, and the river was their lifeblood. The river made such an impression that we find that when the Torah describes for the Jewish people they're coming to the land of Canaan, to the land of Palestine, to the land of Israel, the Torah describes it in terms of Egypt. It is not like Egypt, the Torah says, which has the Nile and therefore has a steady supply of water and can be watered by irrigation at any time that the farmer needs it. But rather, you're coming to a land that you will depend upon rainfall. And you will therefore have to rely, so to speak, more upon God. The Egyptians didn't have to rely upon God because of the Nile. In fact, the Nile was their God, as we'll discuss in a moment. But the Nile was a sure thing. The only problem was that once in a while, the Nile flooded. Well, when it flooded, so it took about 8, 10, 15,000 Egyptians downriver with them. But that was an acceptable risk to the government because the flood also had benefits to it. And the benefits was that it laid down in a whole new section of topsoil and it expanded the valley. and it provided even more water for Egypt. So the Nile was the god of the Egyptians, and it was worshipped as a god. The river was worshipped as a god, and the river's creatures were worshipped as a god. One of the indigenous creatures to the river is the Egyptian crocodile, which still is there today. And in Tanakh it is described for us, the Tanin HaGodol, the great serpent, the great crocodile. A crocodile is a fearsome beast. The crocodile, the alligator, it is not at all a handsome creature. I remember that when I lived in Miami Beach, we were about 25 miles, 30 miles from the Florida Everglades. And in the Florida Everglades, there are alligators. So in the winter season and the summer season, it's impossible to go there because of the heat and the humidity. It's just impossible. But in the winter, oftentimes we would take a ride out there, right? That's a good place to escape your members. And the alligators sleep in the winter, you know, like the yeshiva guys. They're semi-hibernation. And they just lie there in the water with their snout above water. But every so often he gets hungry. So he catches a bird. Or you can see him catch fish. An absolutely fearsome creature. And the ugliest, most fearsome creature imaginable. You can imagine the impression that such an animal made upon a primitive society. And the crocodile became the symbol of Egypt. We find it in the hieroglyphics, we find it on the tombs, we find it in the paintings, and all of the great archaeological evidence that we have regarding Egypt, the crocodile was very, very important to it. And it was the symbol of Egyptian might because it became the symbol of the Nile. And it also became a god. So you find artifacts and statues and idols and icons, all of crocodiles. So you had the river as the god and the inhabitants of the river as the god. The river also brought fish. The Egyptians, out of all the ancient people, ate a fish diet, which I think modern medicine would now say contributed to their good health, longevity, etc., as much as the Japanese eat a fish diet, basically. But they ate a lot of fish. The river was full of fish. And again, when the river overflowed, the fish, you didn't even need nets to catch the fish. And that was a staple part of the diet. It was cheap, it was free in most instances, and it was healthy. The river also provided navigation. The river is navigable from the Mediterranean in the north, from Alexandria in the north, all the way south to the first cataract, all the way down to the Sudan. So that in ancient Egypt, there was almost no wheeled traffic. They didn't have to use wagons, and they didn't use camels, and they didn't use donkeys. They didn't use any of the artifacts that are, any of the methods of transportation which are so popular and well known to us in the Bible, which had to be used in Canaan and Mesopotamia and Babylonia and that area. They used the river. And since everybody lived along the river, so then it was easy to move. And that lent, again, a great facility for commercial enterprise. Things were easily transportable. People could go from one place to another. The river also provided reeds, papyrus reeds, other types of reeds. To us, reeds are, it's like weeds. It's a ubiquitous thing that grows there, but we don't see any purpose to it. In the ancient world, the reeds had great importance. Reeds were used for tools. In fact, in the peasant's home, if he could not afford a knife, he sharpened the reed and used the reed. If you've ever, God forbid, been cut by a reed, you'll know that the cut is as sharp as any sword. reeds were also used to manufacture not paper as the Chinese had paper, but to manufacture parchment, papyrus, which was the basis of having some sort of civilization, because you have to have something to write upon. The Mesopotamians, the Babylonians, wrote upon clay tablets, which are very bulky. I mean, imagine carrying the Encyclopedia Britannica written on clay tablets. And it had a limited use, therefore. And the Egyptians were able to develop as a much more cultured society and a much more intelligent society, and have a history and have a method of conducting commerce, simply because they had, if not paper, at least they had papyrus, they had parchment, they had some method of writing that was not dependent. The Jews were dependent, and in Halacha were dependent upon, for instance, animal skins. You cannot write a Sefer Torah. All the holy artifacts of Judaism have to be written on animal skin. Well, so you got to raise the animal, and you have to shecht it, and you have to take the hide off and process it. It's a long, expensive, and really in economic terms, it's an inefficient process to get 10 columns of parchment. So every time you have to kill a lamb or a goat or a sheep or a cow, it really doesn't pay. And the byproduct, I mean, you have to have somebody to eat the meat, you have to have somebody to sell the hide to, all of those things have to happen. And therefore, all of that stood in the way of really developing a literate society. Whereas in Egypt, the reeds grew by themselves, and they grew in great abundance, and they were cheap, and you could easily convert it to these types of writing, paper, parchment, papyrus, whatever we want to call it. And that's why I think that we have a record, we have the most extensive record of civilization out of anything else with the Egyptians, because they had a culture that was based upon writing, whereas most of the other cultures of the ancient world were based upon oral transmission. And when the people died, then the oral transmission died. The Jewish people have survived, that's why we know our history. But if we had to rely upon our history as well, only on what is written, we would certainly have a fragmentary, incomplete, and probably distorted view of what it was. Because we all know that if you see Torah Shebiksav, the written Torah, without the interpretation of Torah Shebaal Peh, without the input of the oral law, then you get a very skewered image. It's not accurate. And that's based upon the fact that there was an oral tradition. And the Jewish people, having survived, our oral tradition has survived, and therefore we are able to piece everything together. And we can tell you the name of Avraham Avinu's mother, for instance, even though it is not recorded in any of the books of the Bible. But the Egyptians, on the other hand, because they had a literate society, and because they had paper, and because they had scribes, and because more or less they were the most cultured people in the world, so we know a great deal about them. And they themselves have left us the records that we're able to read, once we're able to decipher the hieroglyphics from the time of the Rosetta Stone at the end of the 19th century. For the last 100 years, we're able to read the hieroglyphics, and we're able to see what they were writing about, so then we have a clear idea of what they were. Now, Egyptian society was organized around a government that was despotic, as was all governments in the ancient world. It was a dictator, and the dictator was the pharaoh, the king. Now, the king himself, part of being the pharaoh was that he was a god. It's hard for us to crawl into that period of time, but in the ancient world, paganism was so rampant, and it was so attractive, and it was so necessary, so to speak, for the culture of the society, that the king, the pharaoh, had to be a god. And we the length that the pharaohs went to prove themselves gods. Now, some of them knew better. You know, it's a little like today. There are political leaders who really believe in themselves. Woe to us from them. You know, you get somebody that he really thinks that he's the president of the United States. And you have some people who are more pragmatic, realistic, and who see the humor in the whole thing. And somehow they're able to keep up the pretense, but not to believe it. There were two types of pharaohs also. There were pharaohs who believed in themselves as gods. Even though they knew their own human qualities, they nevertheless believed in themselves as gods. And there were pharaohs who were wise enough to realize that they were not gods, but who perpetuated the idea that they were a god in order to retain political power over the people, and in order not to create waves, in order not to create a new system among the people that all of a sudden, you know, they have a pharaoh who is not a god. In fact, the undoing of the Egyptian Empire will be when the people began to realize that the pharaohs were not gods. Now, we find the same parallelism much later in history with the Roman emperors, who also declared themselves gods. But the Roman emperors did it for a different reason, because under their belief, a god could not be punished for whatever he did. And since in the Roman pantheon of gods there were good gods and not such good gods, you know, there were all kinds of guys there who did all sorts of things. So if you got yourself declared a god, that was like diplomatic immunity, right? They could, the police couldn't do anything to you. So, and the Roman emperors therefore exerted a great deal of pressure. It's very interesting, because that was the only counterbalance between the Roman emperor and the Roman Senate, was that the only way you became a god was that the Roman Senate had to vote you a god, being a god. How that made any sense, you know, how ordinary mortals could vote you into being a god. But be that as it may, but that was the quid pro quo between the Roman emperors and the Senate. I mean, that was the negotiation. If he wanted to be nominated as a god, then he had to give, you know, this senator's brother-in-law a job. And that was the ancient system of political dealing, which exists today in all societies, and which is part of the human condition. But the Roman emperors also latched onto that idea that to be the successful emperor, you have to be the god. That was invented by the pharaohs of Egypt. We see that in the Chumash, where Moshe Rabbeinu always goes to meet Paro, so he always meets him in the bathroom. He goes out to the Nile to meet him, because Pharaoh was a god, and as a god, he never had to go to the bathroom, except that he had to go. So he had a private place, you know, no mixed swimming by the Nile, secluded. And Moshe used to meet him there, right? Which you could imagine was very disconcerting to the Pharaoh. And that was the part of the psychology of the meeting, was to show that, you know, that you may, the Egyptians may think you're a god, but we know better. We're, you know. But he had to keep the pretense going, the Pharaoh. He had to pretend that he was a god. And we have records from the times of the Egyptians that the Egyptian princes were trained in such things, for instance, in being able to stand on their feet for enormous lengths of time, so that everybody else would collapse around them and he'd still be standing, because he was the god. All sorts of weird, which to us are weird, bizarre things, only to create the aura of being the god. And because he was a god, he did no work. Right, that's Mel Brooks says, you know, it's good to be the king. Right, it's good to be the king that's the god, right? He could take a nap in the afternoon. He didn't have to do anything, the Pharaoh. And in, because he didn't have to do anything, that he needed people to run the government. So the power oftentimes among the pharaohs lay with his regent, or with his assistant, or with the viceroy, or the person whom he appointed, who actually ran the government and was the power, except that he was subservient to the Pharaoh. Now, many times these people were extremely talented. I mean, the prime example that we'll discuss next week is that of Joseph, who was the greatest viceroy and who ran the country. It really was his country. But Joseph was wise enough to run the country in such a way that the Pharaoh was not threatened. Some of the viceroys did too good a job. That's the problem always of being an assistant, right? That's probably the most vulnerable position imaginable, because if you don't do the job, then you get fired. And if you do the job, then you get fired, because then you're too great a threat. You know the old bad joke that I always tell about the young man that was an assistant rabbi to an older rabbi. So after 5 years, he came to him and he said, "Rabbi so-and-so," he said, "I've been here 5 years." He says, "I don't want to be called assistant rabbi anymore." I said, "How about if my title is changed to associate rabbi?" So the older man looked at him and he said, "I don't see any objection." He said, "The abbreviation's the same." The problem that's involved is that one cannot, under any circumstances, appear to be too successful. And on the other hand, one must be very successful because you have nobody else running the government. So many an Egyptian viceroy lost his head. And many times Egypt was governed by people who really were incompetent. But again, because of its natural wealth, and because of the resources that it had, and because of the greatness of the country itself, it could stand incompetent leadership. The United States is a good example. There are countries in the world that can stand that, that maybe even thrive on it. And then there are countries that have to be much more nimble, and who don't have any of those blessings, and therefore can only survive on capable leadership and on tremendous industry and on a spirit among the populace, etc., that pushes them forward to be able to survive in a competitive situation. Egypt was really in a non-competitive situation. There was no equal to Egypt in the ancient world. Now, beginning in there are three different divisions of ancient Egypt. One was called the Old Kingdom, one was called the Middle Kingdom, and one was called the New Empire. Now, these are all arbitrary divisions made by modern-day historians to enable us to deal with what is essentially 1,400 years of history. That's a long time, 1,400 years. And to get a handle on it, to be able to deal with it some way, so we had to make some relatively arbitrary differences in order to be able to have an understanding. The Old Kingdom begins, most historians say, about the year 2600-2700 before the Common Era. So we're talking about 4,500 years ago. That's the oldest record that we have of any civilization. It's the same record that we have in the north in Mesopotamia of the first civilization that arises. It's approximately the time of the flood, or a little after the flood, that time when civilization begins to sprout again. There was an article in today's Times, if you saw, on the recent discoveries in northern Babylonia, which confirm, you know, all the stories of the Chumash, of the type of life that was lived. If you want to, it's a good illustration of the times of our father Avraham and the world that he lived in. Well, in Egypt, that was the time of the Old Kingdom. The Old Kingdom had 25 kings from a period beginning in 2600 and going to about 2100. In 500 years, it had 25 kings, which is not a great number of kings for such a long period of time. There was a great deal of stability in the country. And the beginnings of the Egyptian civilization were based upon this development of agriculture, the development of trade within Egypt itself, and the fact that most of the world came to Egypt to trade, because Egypt had the raw materials. They came there to buy. And therefore, the Egyptians were not known for leaving Egypt, but the rest of the world was known for coming to Egypt. The oldest road that we know in the world is the Damascus highway, which runs from Damascus across the Jordan River at the Daughters of Jacob Bridge, across the Galilee to the Mediterranean, and it turns south down the Mediterranean, and it goes to Alexandria, Egypt, following the Mediterranean seacoast. The Romans called that the Via Maris, the road of the sea. It's the oldest road. You should see the potholes on it. It's the oldest road that exists in the world, and it's still in use today. It's basically the highway grid that exists today for a great part of the Middle East. The Egyptians had a natural buffer. The natural buffer was the Sinai Desert. The Egyptian customs houses and defense lines and passport control, whatever we want to call it, was not at the Nile. It was at the Sinai, at the entrance to the Sinai Desert. Whether it was at whether it was up in the Gaza Strip, many archaeologists think that it was in the Gaza Strip, that the city of Gaza itself, until it was controlled by the Philistines, was controlled by the Egyptians, and that was the the customs house. Others think that it was at El Arish, which is about a third of the way into the Sinai, and there is a small river, the only river in the Sinai that flows into the Mediterranean. In Tanakh, it's called Nachal Mitzrayim, the river of Egypt. And it's called Nachal Mitzrayim, the river of Egypt, because that's where the Egyptian border began. And El Arish was the custom house. That's why there's a difference of opinion in halacha as to whether or not that eastern third of the Sinai, or eastern quarter of the Sinai, really has any connection to the land of Israel or not. Most of the Mefarshim seem to think that it has no connection whatsoever. But those who think that it does, so the connection is until El Arish. That would be the place. But those were the Egyptian customs houses, and they had this tremendous buffer. So an invading army that wanted to get to Egypt had to go across the Sinai first, which is not an easy trek. It's a desert, a bitter desert, and therefore Egypt always felt very well protected. Most of the problems that Egypt had came from the tribes to the south, in the Sudan, and it came from the tribes to the west, from Libya, who came across the desert. But again, it was surrounded by a great deal of desert, and being surrounded by so much desert, it felt insulated. You have to have in mind that Egypt was really only this 30-mile strip along the Nile. So the rest of it was, you had plenty of buffer territory. Because of that, Egypt notoriously was not a warlike country. It was not an expansionist country in terms of war. But its expansion always was in terms of trade, in terms of wealth. And the Egyptians looked to control and dominate the Middle East, which they did for centuries. But they did not do it with their armies as much as they did it through their economic pressure, their wealth, their civilization, and the fact that they were the greatest of all nations at their time. At the end of the Old Kingdom, an event occurs. There is an invasion of Egypt in about the year 1700 before the Common Era. Now, it's interesting, this invasion of Egypt was called the invasion of the Hyksos people, Hyksos. And many historians have attempted to compare or to identify the Hyksos with the Hebrews. And this is based, by the way, on Josephus. And Josephus, in order to, book that he wrote, The Antiquities of the Jews, in order to buttress the Jewish claims regarding the Exodus from Egypt, so he embellished the biblical story a little. which he is wont to do in a number of areas of his history book. And he identified the Jews with this Hyksos people. And the Hyksos came to Egypt, and there were six kings who were called the great Hyksos pharaohs. The Hyksos were an alien culture. They were not Egyptian. They were not Egyptian by race, nor were they Egyptian in their religion. The Hyksos kings, out of all of the pharaohs of Egypt, never claimed to be gods. They did not build for themselves any of these tremendous monuments, but they left records, great amounts of written records of their time and of their accomplishments and of what they did. And they moved the capital from the cities to the south, in the south of Egypt, north along the Nile, towards the cities north of the Nile. Josephus points out the proximity of their capitals to the land of Goshen, which is the area where the Jewish people lived. So for a long period of time, there has been an attempt to identify the Hyksos kings somehow with the arrival of the Hebrews in Egypt. Chazal don't give us any basis for that whatsoever. And we know of no other Hebrew kings except Joseph, who never was a king but was only the viceroy. And in fact, all of the evidence that we have was that the Jews attempted to have a low profile in Egypt as far as being members of the government was concerned. In the economy of Egypt, etc., they intended to play a great role. But in terms of the government of Egypt, they were not interested, or they were well aware of the terrible dangers of becoming involved, and they withheld themselves from it. So it's difficult for us to say that the Hyksos kings were the Hebrews, but I want you to know that there is such a theory, and that some people even today maintain that that theory existed. And in either event, it, for instance, can fit in. The Medrash tells us that our teacher Moses was a king in the Sudan for a long period of time. And we do have evidence that the Hyksos peoples ruled not only in Egypt, but in the Sudan, in Libya, and neighboring countries, and that they were a powerful influence. They disappeared. We don't know how they disappeared. A rebellion occurred. We don't have accurate records of what happened, but a rebellion occurred, and evidently they were unable to put down the rebellion, and they were destroyed by the local indigenous population, by the Egyptians themselves. And when that happened in about the year 1560 before the Common Era, the new empire began. And the new empire expelled the Hyksos peoples. In fact, they expelled all aliens. And those aliens whom they did not expel, they enslaved. The time of the new empire is the time of the enslavement of the Jewish people in Egypt. And as Rashi tells us, and as our rabbis inform us, that the Jews were not the only slaves in Egypt, but that Egypt had a very large foreign population composed of people who were enslaved by the Egyptians. And that would fit in perfectly with the descriptions that we have of the times of the new empire, and of their policy towards aliens. They became a very xenophobic, a very narrow people, very provincial. They were only interested in Egyptians. They lost somehow, maybe that was as a reaction to the Hyksos, to the rule of foreigners for a long period of time, but they lost all toleration of foreigners. They couldn't tolerate them, and they saw them as inferior people and as people only to be enslaved and used. And those who didn't want it, they either exterminated or they exiled them. They expelled them from the country. And therefore, rabbis tell us, V'gam Erev Rav Yotso, that when the Jews went out of Egypt, a great mixture, a multitude of other peoples went out with them. And these people nominally converted to be Jews, but they were the source of a great deal of the trouble within the Jewish people for centuries, because they were not ethnically, familially Jews. but they were people who were slaves, and when the Jews went out, that was their ticket to go out. Just as now in the exodus of Jews from Russia, almost one out of every 10 who comes out as a Russian Jew is not a Jew. But that's the ticket. The way to get out is to say that you're Jewish and you got a relative in Israel and you want to go. Because if you say you're Ukrainian and you want to go to Chicago, you're never going to get out. So you have very strange bedfellows in this thing. You have very, very strange things that happen. But that was the ticket to get out, was to be Jewish. And in so many of these enslaved peoples, many of these strange peoples came out with the Jewish people in the Exodus. Now, three things happened in the New Empire, all of which is the backdrop to the story of Joseph and the Jews coming to Egypt and the Jews themselves in Egypt. And the three things coincide. As you realize, all of Jewish history is played against the backdrop of world history, but all of world history is intertwined with the Jewish people, and therefore there's a reason why all of this happens at the same time, why all of these facts converge and impinge upon each other in order to make a situation where the Jewish people come to Egypt, become Egyptians, and they're driven out of Egypt and are chosen to be the people that receive the Torah, etc. The first thing that happened was that a new type of Pharaoh arose, far greater than the Pharaohs who had existed before, who not only claimed to be gods, but who didn't give the government over to viceroys anymore. They didn't take a nap in the afternoon. But they were a breed of warrior-like, able administrator, aggressive personality, forcible people who now took the initiative and were not satisfied with the wealth of Egypt and were not satisfied that the whole world came to Egypt. But they went to sell everybody. They wanted to take over the whole world. They dreamt. They were the first imperialists. The first ones who dreamt, that's why it's called the New Empire. The other ones were called the Old Kingdom and the Middle Kingdom. That's just the kingdom. This is the empire. They wanted the world. They were not satisfied. I have always my experience with the Japanese is that there's a plant in Japan that manufactures food-grade glycerin, which is used in the manufacture of shortening. Like Crisco, you know, vegetable shortening. So you have to add glycerin to hold the thing together. Now, in Israel, you cannot import any food-grade glycerin unless it's kosher. Now, how much food-grade glycerin does Israel import? 10,000 barrels a year, 15,000 barrels. I mean, it's not, you know, it's a limit. It's a small country. It's limited. And they make some of it there. This plant in Japan, in Osaka, so they opened up a plant. So they called, when I was with the OU, they called me up one day and they say, you know, how would you like to come to Japan? So I go, sure, I'd like to come to Japan. We need, you know, we need rabbinic certification, etc. And they go through the whole thing, and they got a plant there that's enormous. Just as a matter, they have a plant in Osaka. The United States has the same plant in Cincinnati, Ohio, Procter & Gamble at Ivorydale. Ivorydale has 400 people working. They have 40 in the same plant. Do you want to compete with them? And so when it was all over, and, you know, and it's so they make it from petroleum. See, they buy petroleum from Saudi Arabia to convert it to food grade glycerin. So an American rabbi gave him a hechsher so that they can sell it in Meir Shorim, right, for the Hadar cookies. You don't think God is funny? So I asked him. I said, "What do you guys need it for? And what do you need the OU for?" He said, oh, we have to sell Israel, and we can't sell Israel, and we can't bring in an Israeli rabbi, because then the Arabs, we sell the Arabs too, so we can't have an Israeli rabbi, because that'll violate the Arabs, so we go to the mayor, you know, the Israelis told us that if the OU says, all right, they'll take it, so I said to him, what do you guys need Israel? I mean, how many barrels are they saying? Oh, no, he says, any market in the world, this the guy tells me straight, any market in the world is our market. Now that's imperialism. That's the psychology that you have to have. That's what drives them to the and they're not kidding, right? They mean it. Well, Egypt had that psychology in the new empire. When the new empire came, the breed of the pharaoh was that any place in the world had to be Egyptian. And therefore, they were changing from a passive, agricultural, easygoing, pacifist society to a much more aggressive, imperial, trading empire. Now, that requires people. Aside from everything else, you've got to have people behind it. And therefore, Egypt, for the first time, looked for people to move to Egypt. It looked for a greater population. It looked for a stronger, wider economic base. And to use a bad pun, you know, they needed a wider base to the pyramids. And in order to do so, we understand why Pharaoh said to Joseph, hey, he said, you got brothers, what can they do? You know, maybe, you know, maybe we can do something with them too. Maybe you got some more, bring them here. Because it's a change in the whole Egyptian psychology. The change in the Egyptian psychology is from the easygoing, non-aggressive, non-imperial, self-sufficient nation to the great empire, which wants to dominate all of the world. And it did dominate it. It conquered all of Palestine. It conquered most of Mesopotamia. The Egyptian influence took over even all the Phoenician cities to the north, so that the Phoenician traders had to do so under the consent and the imprimatur of the pharaoh. And we have found in the archaeology diggings in Lebanon, we have found vast treasures of Egyptian markings and trade books and rules and all sorts of things. Because they were under Egyptian domination. They had to do what Egypt told them to do. See, the first thing is the arrival of empire building, imperialism. It's a new departure in the world. All the other empires that we had, you know, those are all small kingdoms. Those are kings of really city-states. And nobody ever stayed. I mean, if they defeated you in a war, so then they captured everything and they burned the town and then they all went home. Nobody ever stayed. Nobody ever wanted to convert that territory permanently into theirs. You didn't have the manpower. You didn't have the governing thing for it. The Egyptians, on the other hand, did. The Egyptians, when they came now, they stayed. They intended to colonize all of their conquests. That's the idea of empire. The second major change was the famous Emperor Akhenaten, who, again, is sometime between the time of Jacob and the beginning of the enslavement of the Jewish people, was this Emperor Akhenaten, who was falsely, he's understood as being a monotheist. He isn't a monotheist in our sense of monotheism and believing in one God that creates all. But what he did was he imposed one God on Egypt. Egypt had a multiplicity of gods. Everybody had their own God. And paganism was a very egalitarian society because, you know, if you had 100 gods, you could have 101 gods. You know, the religious toleration was always present in paganism. You have in Japan today, for instance, 70% of the population is Buddhist and 30% of the population is Shinto. Yet you don't have religious wars in Japan. Whereas in Europe or in other places, if you had a split like that, you would have problems all the time. The answer is that in a monotheistic society, monotheism by definition is exclusive. If I'm right, you're wrong. We can't both be right. That's the problem, the basic problem why, you know, why the Pope is going to visit Waldheim again. Because it's bothering him, right? Can't be. Somebody's got to be right and somebody's got to be wrong. That's the basis of a monotheistic society. And that's why the wars of monotheism are far more bitter and last longer and are not given to any easy solutions. Whereas in the pagan society, you know, listen, if you got 100 gods, you can have 100 more. You know, you got another god, good, we'll put him on the list too. Why not? Right? You need another statue, good, here it is. Right? Put it up there. Why not? Akhenaten was the exception to that rule. He destroyed all the other gods except his god. His god was the sun god. And he was the first religious fanatic, let me put it that way, that we find in Egypt. An emperor who was a religious fanatic and who would not brook any deviation from his definition of what religion should be. His definition of God, his definition of the universe, etc. You have to do it his way. And he is the one who put into the Egyptian society the virus of religious discrimination. Until then, it was the Egyptians versus the foreigners. Well, that's understood, right? That's in every society. You know, the aliens and the ones who are the citizens. But he added a new dimension to it. A very dangerous dimension, and that's the dimension that the Jewish people will suffer from, is that the ritual of the Jewish people, the religion of the Jewish people, the view of God, so to speak, of the Jewish people, their beliefs would be anathema to the Egyptians because of the fact that the Egyptians under Akhenaten came to religious fanaticism. They came to an exclusivity of belief that did not brook allowing anyone else to have any other beliefs. So even after the death of Akhenaten, and when Egypt falls back into its very many different forms of gods and its different types of paganism, but it never falls back to the tolerance, so to speak, that existed at the beginning of its pagan existence. It never gets back to that. And it remains, therefore, religiously speaking, a very narrow and dangerous society. It is just not willing to allow people to be different. And that's a problem that the Jewish people faced in their first exile and that the Jewish people face in all later exiles. I always mention that the best of all worlds is religious Jews and non-religious Gentiles. And the worst of all worlds is the opposite, unfortunately, right? Which we still suffer from a little. But you have a religious, strongly religious, non-Jewish world, you have problems. You have problems. They will prove themselves eventually to be terribly intolerant. And in their intolerance always comes persecution, discrimination, terrible difficulties for the Jewish people. Whereas in a society that is less hung up about those things, then somehow the atmosphere has been better. There are exceptions. I mean, you have a society like Russia, communism, but what Russian communism did was just inherit the anti-Semitism of Russia, which had built up over 1,000 years, and they just never dropped it. And the secular anti-Semitism of the left, which exists in the world, is the same product. But basically speaking, the religious fanaticism always worked against the Jewish people. The third and last change in Egypt, which affects the Jewish people, affects them greatly, is the conversion of Egypt into a slave society. Slaves always were part of the ancient world. In fact, they are part of the world even today. Hard to define it, but in the In the ancient world, slavery was not only an institution, it was, economically speaking and socially speaking, at least in their eyes, it was a necessary institution. It was the only way the country could run. And slaves did work that ordinary citizens would not do. And they did it at a price that looked cheap, even though eventually it was far more expensive than paying people to do it. All slave societies eventually collapse of a combination of economic sabotage, of sloth, of inefficiency, of all of the things that eventually catch up to it. But it takes hundreds of years to do it. I mean, the Roman Empire was undone by slavery. The South was undone by slavery here in the United States. To a certain extent, that was true of many, many areas in the world today that are undone by the fact that their labor is done, practically speaking, in an involuntary method, and therefore you don't get much done or much accomplished. Egypt, in the new empire, transformed itself into a slave society. It undertook mass building projects. The building projects that have remained that we see are the enormous temples, the pyramids, palaces that have been preserved and are the tourist attractions of our time. They are monumental things which even today we don't understand how they were built, especially with the tools at hand at that time. Just as if you go to the land of Israel and you see the great stones that Herod moved and erected in all of his buildings, you cannot understand how in the world that happened. How did they move it? Only now are beginning to fathom it. There was an article on Caesarea, on the port of Caesarea in the National Geographic within the past year, where they have finally pieced together how he was able to build the port and to sink the pilings into the Mediterranean and the vast concrete blocks, etc. It's just mind-boggling. But he did it also with slave labor. He had 30,000 slaves doing it. So out of the 30,000 slaves, 6,000 died doing it. Well, you know, that was the cost of doing it. But if you have compunctions about the 6,000 people, if you don't feel that the monument is worth 6,000 lives, so then the monument doesn't get built, at least in the ancient world. Now, the Egyptians converted themselves into a slave society because of their enormous construction projects, because of now becoming an empire, because of now they had the requirements to have a larger army and to go to war. All of that requires the logistics. It all requires an infrastructure which allows it to occur. And that building of a slave society changed the social nature of Egypt, and it changed the relationship of Egypt towards its neighbors and towards anyone who came to Egypt. Egypt now looked at everybody else as grist for its mill. People who somehow could be enslaved and brought into Egypt, somehow could be used by Egypt, that's what they saw it as. And therefore, when Joseph and his brothers come to Egypt, it is to a fearsome Egypt that they are coming to. It's not the benign Egypt that we saw in the time of Avraham, when Avraham goes and escapes, and Avraham talks to Paro one-to-one, and Paro admits he's wrong and gives him gift. It's not the Egypt that Yitzhak wanted to go to. It's a different Egypt. And as fearsome as the Egypt was that Yosef and his brothers came to, it is no comparison to the Egypt that will be a century later, that will take the Jewish people and enslave them. And in its drive for world power and imperialism, and its drive to build its economy, its drive to become the greatest empire, we have records of Egyptians the Egyptian slogans that Hitler echoed, right? Hitler wanted the Reich to last 1,000 years. The Egyptians also talked in terms of eternity, the Egyptian empire forever, the Egyptian empire that would last for thousands of years. And they really thought that it would. I have a chance to talk to you about Yetzias Mitzrayim, about the Exodus. We'll see that Egypt disappeared overnight. And we have very little records as to what happened. I mean, from the Chumash we know what happened. But Egypt thought that it was going to last forever. And it built itself on that basis. And it changed its nature and its society and its economy and everything else. All of that is the backdrop to the entry of the Jewish people into Egypt. If the Jewish people would have gone into Egypt 100 years earlier or 200 years earlier, it would have been a different story. If they would have gone 200 years later, it would have been another different story. But they went then. And when they went at that time, that's why the story of Yosef and the story of the enslavement of the Jewish people in Egypt takes on such meaning and such depth for us, because we're aware of the historical changes occurring and how the Jewish people played a role in those changes and how they were affected by it as well.
This concludes Lecture 95 on Egypt, Feudalism and Imperialism by Rabbi Beryl Wein. For information, please contact the Destiny Foundation at 1-800-499-WINE. That's 1-800-499-9346. We can also be reached by email at info@jewishdestiny.com. Shop online at www.rabbiwine.com. Due to copyright laws, we kindly request that there be no duplication of this lecture.